From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Just before things shifted in our world, I bought a new vegetarian cookbook called Start Simple by today's guest, Lucas Vulgar. Little did I know that just weeks later, its promise of an uncomplicated approach to cooking that allows you to use what you already have on hand to make great meals you didn't think were possible would sound not just appealing, but really the order of the day. We'll talk about dependable, versatile ingredients and how to use them and how to make vegetables last, but first this message.
Programming and underwriting support from Brushwood Nursery. For more than 20 years, Brushwood Nursery has shipped the finest selection of clematis and other vines all over the United States with full gallon-sized plant and free shipping. Their website is full of beautiful pictures and information on growing clematis. Brushwoodnursery.com. And underwriting support from Garden Tool Company. Garden Tool Company's wide selection of heirloom quality tools for your gardening passion is backed by outstanding customer service, fast shipping, and ongoing support. GardenToolCompany.com.
Lucas Vulgar is the author of three previous cookbooks and the co-founder and editorial director of Jerry Magazine, an award-winning biannual publication that explores where food and queer culture intersect. He's here today to talk about ideas from his latest book, Start Simple, that can help us cook better no matter what ingredients we have on hand. Hi, Lucas. How are you?
Hi, Margaret. I'm good. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
Yes. Well, I'm enjoying the book so much. And as I said, it's almost eerie how timely it is. Of course, you didn't write Start Simple to help us through such unforeseen times, but here we are and here it is. And the book subtitle is 11 Everyday Ingredients for Countless Weeknight Meals. So I presume those are your staples, and tell us a little bit about those.
Yes, exactly. I sort of started the book by examining my shopping habits and realize that these ingredients are ones that I'm always putting in my basket, whether I'm aware of it or not. So that ended up being the organizing principle of the book. And mm-hmm. So what we've got are hearty greens, beans canned and dried. There's summer squash like zucchini and yellow squash, eggs, cauliflower and broccoli, winter squash, cabbage, mushrooms, tofu, corn tortillas, and sweet potatoes. Those are the ingredients that organize the book.
Right. Good things for everybody to try to put in their market basket for those curbside pickup boxes if they can, I think.
Yeah.
Are you a vegetarian? I mean, this cookbook is vegetarian. I am for like 40-something years. I just wondered if you were too.
Yeah, I'm not a strict vegetarian anymore. I have been for various stretches of my life, and I'll probably go back to it again. Right now, it's hard to explain. This is my default style of cooking. It's like weeknight cooking is always, you know, when I'm cooking at home, it's always vegetarian, but I just have a sort of more lax approach when I'm eating at someone else's house or going out to eat. And that's just kind of what's working for me right now.
Yeah. Well, the book really has this, let's see what I've got in my kitchen premise as the start of meal making, as you say, early on in the book, and sort of not the what can I go buy right now premise. And by the way, I should tell people, I love your e-newsletter and your Instagram feed. And I'll tell people in the transcript of the show where we'll also have a book giveaway. I'll tell them how to get subscribed to those with the links. But I believe it was last winter when you were doing like, I don't know, an oatmeal challenge or something like that, that I got totally hooked. Tell us about things like, because oatmeal is not one of the things you just named, but you know, you love good, basic, solid ingredients that can do a lot of things, don't you?
Yes, exactly. And the oatmeal, well, that's, I've done this challenge for myself 3 years in a row, and it's for the month of February, and it's a hashtag I called 28 days of oatmeal, even though this past year I had to do 29 days. But and it was exactly that. It was one of those things where I realized, like, you know what? I eat oatmeal almost every day.
Yeah.
And it is actually this blank canvas for all kinds of different toppings. And so the challenge was to change up my my daily oatmeal every day and document it on Instagram. And it ended up being one of those things that really resonated with people because I think they, too, were, you know, eating oatmeal, maybe not every day, but eating it pretty often. and had kind of fallen into ruts with their toppings and didn't even really think to change it up. But I think it's one of those dishes that help you sort of begin to cook intuitively and to begin to cook with sort of what you've got. So in the captions of that, I'm always just like oatmeal with poached egg and soy sauce and scallions and sesame seeds. And you can sort of like immediately grasp how that comes together without having to, put it into a recipe. And so, yeah, that definitely informs the way I cook and the way I'm always trying to get people to learn how to become better cooks and more intuitive cooks and more resourceful cooks with the things that they've got on hand.
Yeah. And so also, I think it was on Instagram recently, you had, and this is going to sound nutty to people probably at first when I just say the words roasted chard stems. You had a picture of roasted chard stems, and you would think, what the heck? Why do I want to eat chard stems? But it's just what you said. It's that sort of, it's even beyond waste not, want not. It's like some of these bits and pieces just can make a whole other dish or an embellishment or a flavor additive thing. So what about roasted chard stems and the like? Because there seem to be tricks like that in all your books.
Yeah, the chard stems, is such a revelation. And it really doesn't, it's one of those things that you really can't quite believe it until you do it. Because I feel like there are all these people that are saying, kale stems, dice them up and add them to your stir fries. And I can't, I waste as little as possible, but I can't fully get on board with kale stems. They're just too fibrous to really enjoy. So I'll throw those into a juice or I'll compost them. But the chard stems just become, something completely, it's like they almost turn into this delicious, like spring vegetable that's really tender and has this, I think of it as like an almost asparagus-y flavor, but so different from the leaves. And I'm always saving those and roasting them in like a hot oven around 400 degrees. And you just want to cook them until, they're quite tender. I think it's best when the crunch is removed from them. And it usually takes about 15, 20 minutes. But then just chop those up and I add them either to my greens that I've sauteed, or I'll throw them into a taco filling or in any area, like into an omelet, into a grain bowl, something like that. And it's just, it's crazy that there is this vegetable like Swiss chard that has the leaves, which are one thing, and the stems, which are another thing entirely. And it's just like, it's kind of a little miracle.
Yeah. speaking of greens, you have a recipe in the book. And, here we all are with our, curbside pickup boxes, as I said before, of whatever. And maybe hopefully we're patronizing during this time when shopping is difficult, patronizing local farms and alternatives to be able to get fresh stuff. You have a greens recipe that's deceptively simple, marinated greens. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, so this is, it sort of comes from the place of me getting home from the farmer's market to my apartment in Brooklyn. And having several, I eat a lot of greens, so I'm always buying, three, four bunches of greens at a time to last me a stretch of days. And having to make space in the fridge for all those greens when they're in their raw state is one of the tasks I find more tedious than other tasks. And so the whole idea here is that rather than trying to find space in the fridge, I'm cleaning them and cooking them down and then taking them a step further where I'm marinating them, which is just, I'm coating them in some fresh olive oil and seasoning with some pepper flakes and salt and pepper. And it's just kind of like front loading the labor of dealing with the greens. And then it also, this is something that I've been hoping to convey to readers and that I think has been clicking a little bit. It helps people and it helps me indeed to see the greens after they're cooked like that as sort of a component of a dish. So I end up using those greens and as like an enchilada filling or an omelet filling or in all kinds of various ways where, from like a recipe standpoint, it helps take the reader out of the granular, line by line ingredient list and steps. And it helps them see that, all I'm doing is like cooking some scrambled eggs here and then turning that into an omelet with a handful of these greens and a few little onions that I pickled in some vinegar and a little bit of yogurt. And that's that. So, I tried to do something like the marinated greens with each of these vegetables, each of these essential ingredients, so as to help think of these prepared dishes as like components as that help. I'm sorry, I feel like I'm rambling a little bit, but the idea is to see recipes more as an assembly of various components than as a granular line by line sort of get out of the minutia of a recipe, which
right.
I think will help people to cook more intuitively in the long run.
Yeah. And to see that one, learning that one simple thing means that you have on hand, not dissimilar to the fact that you have your oatmeal on hand, because I read in the book, I believe that you, or some, maybe I read it on your Instagram or whatever, you make oatmeal every week, I think, like I do. You make steel cut oats, I think. You make a big batch and you use that during the week. Yeah. And so in the same way, you've taken your farmer's market haul of greens and some of them you've turned into this thing that can then be incarnated in a few different ways during the week. Which is great, I think. I mean, so much smarter. And I also love, I mean, some of the flavors, like I love sweet potatoes, and sweet potatoes appear in the book, I think, a couple times, I think. And you talk about maybe combining them with miso, and that I have a jar of miso in the door of my fridge, and I have sweet potatoes, and I was like, what? I've never thought of that. Tell us about that, how that is.
Yeah, this is... Well, I feel like miso is one of those ingredients that a lot of people will buy for a specific recipe, and then it sort of languishes in the fridge. Maybe it's to make miso soup, or it's to make, a marinade or something. And it's one that a lot of people might not see the versatility of it. And so that's one that I mean, especially with the oatmeal in the early days of my oatmeal challenge, I was like, oh, miso, a spoonful of miso, just stirring that into my my steel-cut oats, like, towards the end of the cooking, or even when I'm reheating them, it just takes the oatmeal in an entirely different direction. And that whole, the sweet savory component, which is especially good in oatmeal because oatmeal really lends itself to all these savory treatments. It just helped me to see the potential of this. And, you know, that's a flavor that just tastes good in all kinds of different places. And I think that with vegetarian cooking as well, those sorts of fermented, ingredients like miso and the soy sauce and kimchi and things like that, they really can help pull a lot of weight in the flavor department when you don't have sort of, meat that ends up being this, huge buffer in terms of like flavor and texture and all that stuff.
Yeah. So it's funny because the miso, of course, has a sort of saltiness. And so one of my favorite things with sweet potatoes is Parmesan cheese, which might sound insane.
Sometimes
when I have
delicious.
Nothing for dinner, I bake a sweet potato. I always have brown rice in the fridge as well as oatmeal. And I might just have mashed up some sweet potato and have it with my rice and have some Parmesan cheese. And it's that salty, sweet, the different texture, and I'm a happy person. So, So when I saw the miso, I thought, I'm going to like that. I'm going to like that. So when you bring home your greens, you said some of them you might cook. Are there other things that you sort of, especially now at the moment where ingredients are so precious, are you doing any other tricks to kind of have more longevity between shopping trips and so forth of any of your vegetables?
Well, the marinated greens has been one that's really come in handy lately, so that I can continue to have the greens. But I think in general, it's the whole... When I see a vegetable starting to turn, that's when I know I just need to cook it, whether or not I'm ready to eat it. By cooking it, you'll add a few days to its shelf life. So this is with the greens, which look like they might be getting a little wilty, or with squash or sweet potatoes. I find that once I cook them, then it'll be easier to cook them later. It'll be easier to consume them later on, but then it also adds a couple days to the shelf life of the vegetable. But with the squash, and I'm often buying like butternut squash or a kabocha squash, I will cook those, whenever I have the time. And then I scoop the flesh out and mash it up. And similar to the greens, I'll season that with some salt and pepper and a little bit of olive oil, and sometimes throw some toasted sesame oil in there or a little bit of lemon zest or things to give it a little bit more character. But it just ends up creating that sort of like component rather than an assembly of ingredients that I just makes dinner that much faster when it comes time to cook.
Right. It's an at the ready component. Now, I'm a one person household, so and I cook all my food myself. So I don't live in an area where there's like takeout food or whatever very much. And so a lot of times when I make a recipe or a whole butternut squash or a whole thing of greens, it's too much for one or even two or even three or even four servings. And I even portion it and freeze it in some cases. So do you know what I mean? It might be for next week, too.
Yep.
So, I mean, not
absolutely
perfect sometimes, and with certain things it's better than with others, but generally speaking, mm-hmm. with most of the vegetables, I do it, you know.
Yeah, and to freeze them after you cook them, especially
That's what I mean,
that just, like, sort of locks in the color, at least.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, burgers. You did a whole veggie burger cookbook a while back, I think maybe, 2010-ish or something?
Yeah, it was 10 years ago, which I find hard to believe.
Yeah. It's called Veggie Burgers Every Which Way. And that's another cookbook that would be great to have on hand right now, by the way. And I think you even had a vegetable burger business. And speaking of veggie burgers in the new book, In Start Simple, there's one with white beans and carrots. And I was so wanting to have panko crumbs, which in my cupboard that I didn't have. Because I read the recipe for that, and I thought, "Ooh, that sounds like such a good burger." So you make, you're sort of like you're the master of the veggie burger universe or something. And I just wondered, is there some sort of basic rule of thumb about veggie burgers? Like you need a binder and a bean and a I don't know what. I mean, to make it work.
Yeah, I definitely have a sort of a formula in the back of my mind. My thing with veggie burgers is that I've always thought the most exciting potential for them is to express vegetables in new and interesting ways. And so my veggie burgers are always, they always highlight some specific vegetable or maybe a pair of vegetables. It's never been the goal to try to make it taste like meat or approximate meat flavor.
No.
And so with that new veggie burger, that's a carrot and white bean burger where you cook down some shallots and grated carrots with a little tomato paste and some apple cider vinegar and so it gets a little blistery and soft, and then you really just mash in two cans of beans and add an egg and then some breadcrumbs for the binder. And so that's the easiest formula that I find for veggie burgers. With vegan ones where we wouldn't use the egg, it's a little trickier because there are different types of vegan binders that and they all work differently. One of my favorites is just like a steamed potato that this is like one of those accidents where, you know, when you put a potato in the food processor, it turns into wallpaper glue, which I know is not something you're supposed to do. But in the world of veggie burgers, it's actually quite helpful because it turns into a really sticky and fail-safe binder. But so that's one of my favorites. So using the steamed potato and a little bit of potato starch. And there are some egg replacers that work. Sometimes like a flax egg will work, but that's a little bit looser and wetter. So the vegan binders are a little trickier, and I think you have to be recipe specific with them. Mm-hmm. And then the other component there is the binder, which when I'm using wheat-based breadcrumbs like panko or homemade breadcrumbs, they're sort of like the easiest in this formula of like the beans and the vegetables and then the egg and then the breadcrumbs. With gluten-free ones, the gluten-free stuff absorbs things a little bit differently. But there's a trick that one of my friends who's a cookbook author, Jody Moreno, she wrote a book called, now I'm blanking on the name, but she has this great trick for gluten-free breadcrumbs where you cook quinoa and then you toast it in the oven after it's cooked. And it ends up really mimicking breadcrumbs. They have sort of that like flaky but somewhat coarse quality. And then they end up being really pleasantly absorbent. So that's something I want to try more in my veggie burgers. I haven't gotten around to it yet. And her book, now I remember, is called More with Less.
In the book, you have a number of uses of cabbage. And that's something that keeps well. But when you get a head of cabbage, it's a big thing. But you have like a great, easy, cheesy cabbage and white bean soup in Start Simple, you know, a can of beans and some cabbage, and it just really uses easy pantry staples. And then you have a whole section of slaws, like one with the quinoa again with a, I think a brown sugar Dijon vinaigrette, and lots of interesting slaws. And I think that's another thing that a lot of us don't make that we could, you know, the slaw is a side dish, a salad instead of a salad kind of thing. Yes.
The slaw. Oh yeah. Using cabbage sort of as the salad green.
Yeah. Like a, not a cooked side dish, a vegetable and not a salad as in lettuce, but this is, I don't make slaw. And I saw you had, I think, three of them in the book, and I thought, oh, that's a good idea. And it's going to be kind of crunchy and delicious. And yeah. One was Asian inspired, I think with tofu and, mm-hmm. A honey soy kind of dressing and sesame and, you know, really interesting. And one had another secret, one of your secret ingredients, charred scallions. Tell us about charred scallions.
Yeah, that's one of those like flavor bombs. I was just going to say about the slaw. I feel like in working on this book was the first time that I thought that, oh, a slaw can actually be a meal. You can make that pretty hearty with, you know, I've got a couple recipes in here. One that's with lentils and some frizzled shallots, and that you use the shallot oil and the vinaigrette, and then put you crispy fry shallots, and then use that shallot oil and the vinaigrette, and some, you know, chopped up almonds in there, and it's a really good sort of main dish salad. And then the one with the tofu, and there's some orange in there, and like a honey soy vinaigrette. But I was thinking about cabbage when you asked me about our current cooking conditions, because right now, one of the things that I'm really craving is just crunch. And
yes.
That could just be that it's spring and we're starting to, like, and seasonal appetite is revving back up. But I find that cabbage, I'm using that more than I am sort of like a salad green, just because I'm craving the crunch so much. And also because that head of cabbage is going to last so much longer than any other salad greens that I might be able to get.
Right, right. So in the last couple few minutes, last three, 4 minutes, I have to ask, because we've all heard about everyone stocking up on beans, and more beans, and there's a run on beans. Beans are now a thing. I mean, I eat beans every day for a million years, but now everybody's eating them. I loved your brothy beans recipe, and it's barely even a recipe, really. Can you just kind of tell us about that?
So the brothy beans is that sort of core recipe for the beans chapter. I'm trying to convey to readers that they can, you know, a pot of beans and their bean broth is delicious on its own when it's cooked properly. But it's also a pretty versatile ingredient. And so to make the brothy beans, I mean, it's a pretty similar method to most other bean methods when you're cooking it on the stovetop. You're just soaked beans and cooking them with a good couple glugs of olive oil and salting them pretty well. And I'm always surprised that people don't think of the bean cooking liquid as an aspect of the pot of beans. You know, like a lot of people strain that off without knowing that it's so delicious and it's such a wonderful ingredient to use in soups and stews and braises. And so, it's very, very simple. And then I go on to use those beans. There's one recipe in the book for it's like baked white beans and chicories, where mm-hmm. you're kind of cooking down some aromatics, some fennel and some carrots and some onion, and you're adding some radicchio and endive, and that starts to cook down. And then sort of you're taking essentially that recipe of the pot of beans with the bean cooking liquid and adding that and then throwing it into the oven. And it just turns into this wonderful, like, super complex flavor that the endive and the radicchio are just like such different ingredients once they're cooked like that, and they become really succulent. And it's just such a hearty, warming, delicious dish. So I'm trying in the book to show that pot of beans as, you know, a dish of its own, but also sort of an ingredient that you can
take
in a couple of different directions.
Right. Well, I'm grateful to have, in time, bought a copy of Start Simple, Lucas Volker. I'm very grateful to have it, and I'm enjoying it, and I'm going to start cooking more from it. So thank you so much for making the time today. And we'll have a book giveaway, as I said, with the transcript and so forth, and I'll tell people how to find you on Instagram and your wonderful newsletter as well. So thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Margaret.
Talk to you again soon.
Programming and underwriting support from Garden Tool Company. Garden Tool Company's wide selection of heirloom quality tools for your gardening passion is backed by outstanding customer service, fast shipping, and ongoing support. GardenToolCompany.com. Programming and underwriting support from Brushwood Nursery. For more than 20 years, Brushwood Nursery has shipped the finest selection of clematis and other vines all over the United States with full-gallon-sized plant and free shipping. Their website is full of beautiful pictures and information on growing clematis. Brushwoodnursery.com.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or at Facebook or on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening and cooking meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.